What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle, where we talk about work, ministry, and the people who make an art out of bringing them together. This is episode 22, and I am bringing to you a woman named Allison. And so Allison came to me because JJ, my wife, told me that I had to have this person on, that she had heard her speak on another podcast, and that she was just a must-have. And I've got to tell you, JJ does not disappoint. This woman, Allison, has co-written a book. It's called Boundaries for Your Soul, and it is a for sure must read. I have a link to it in show notes if you're looking to pick it up. Do that. I would highly recommend it. She is just an amazing person to talk through mental health, and I'm going to tell you right now that you are going to hear the gospel today, and you're going to hear it through mental health, and you're just going to hear it in a really profound way. We talk about all sorts of stuff. We talk about her acting career that she had for a brief period of time. We are all over the place. There is just such good stuff here. I really encourage you to listen and just take in what she's saying and see how it sort of might apply to you. We love our mental health professionals here at Theology of Hustle. So make sure you are subscribed right now on whatever way you get your podcast. Make sure that you know when new episodes come out. If you can, rate and review me while you're thinking about it, because you'll forget by the end of the episode. Give me a rating and review and share this episode if you get something out of it that you feel like people need to hear. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Allison. Well, hey, Allison, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, I know summer for both of us gets a little hectic, but we finally got together and,
yes.
You know, it's just amazing how that happens. Well, why don't we jump off here and just have you just introduce yourself to us a little bit of your story there.
Sure. Well, we connected through the book I just wrote. So I'm a counselor. I live in the Boston area with my family, where I practice. I have a sort of part-time counseling practice, and then I'm a writer, and I just published my first book. And so that's sort of the space I occupy here in New England. from kind of all over the country. We can get into that more later, but that's where I am right now.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back. I'm really interested in your education, first of all. So you have a PhD in religion and psychology. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so what does that mean?
You know, back in the day, I was sort of carving my own path and thinking, what am I doing? And in hindsight, it's worked out great. But I studied psychology a little bit as an undergrad. I was at a secular school up in New Hampshire, where studying psychology was really in the lab. You know, I was learning statistics and learning how to do quantitative data. And that wasn't what I thought of as psychology. So I went on and I got my master's in counseling at a seminary. And what we did there was almost the complete opposite. We studied, you know, some theories of counseling, but it was very theoretical, very abstract, and then a lot of sort of your basic kind of how to build rapport with people, how to have empathy, how to, you know, just some of those basic skills that are super important to being a counselor, and then how to integrate kind of scriptural truth. And that was great. I learned a lot. But in my mind, I was like, I still wasn't sure how the classes that I actually liked the best in seminary were theology classes. So as I'm learning about God, and I'm learning about the fact that we're made in the image of God, and I'm learning about the idea that God is both transcendent, but he's also immanent. He's also with us. I'm like, well, that has a lot to do with psychology, doesn't it? Like, why is nobody like talking about how these things actually overlap? And so I just kind of kept pushing through and ended up in doctoral work, where it just so happened that the University of Denver, where I was living, had a joint degree in religious and psychological studies, where that's exactly what we studied, is how does what we know about God bear on what we know about the psyche, which always used to mean, the Greek word was soul. It came as a discipline psychology became sort of a study of the mind or more of a science. And there's some validity in that, but really the bigger picture idea of what it means to be human. And so that was just sort of always my personal quest, both personally and intellectually, of like, how as a Christian, I want to know a lot about God, and I know a lot about God, and I love God, but I also need to kind of know myself and who I am and how God has made me uniquely and how those two things come together.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what was your dissertation regarding then?
Yeah, it was on the relationship of between religion and prejudice. Okay. And so I did a bunch of surveys and studied how different people think about religion and how that impacts how they feel toward other people who are not like them.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. That sounds like that could be a whole podcast itself there.
For sure.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. So your vocational history though is not, I guess, like other people's, where you sort of go to college, you get a degree, and then you move into your field and just sort of are there, right? You have a very eclectic vocational history.
Yeah.
Do you mind just sort of walking us through sort of your path vocationally?
Sure. I mean, part of the eclectic nature of it is that I was in graduate school for so long that I had to be working a lot on the side to pay the bills.
I've been there. Yeah. Yes.
It's like, okay, what do I do? I started working in high school, you know, from, you know, waiting tables to I've always just kind of liked work. I don't know why. I worked for my dad. And so when I got out of college, my very first job was in Washington, D.C. I moved down there with a friend, and we both got jobs on Capitol Hill. I worked for my congressman. I'm from Wyoming, of all places. So
really, Wyoming?
Yes, we have one.
Wyoming's amazing.
Yes, we have one congressperson. And at that time, it was a woman in all of Congress. There's one.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I got that. I did that for 2 years, kind of knowing, you know, I'm not super drawn to a career in politics and wasn't ready to go straight into graduate school. And it just kind of seemed like a interesting thing to do while figuring things out.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So the Capitol Hill, and then, that was during grad school?
No, that was right after undergrad and before graduate school.
Okay. Gotcha. And then, so you ended up out in Colorado for graduate school and your PhD?
So two things that I learned while I was in Washington, D.C. So working on Capitol Hill, it was actually I would encourage anybody to take, you know, I didn't take a gap year between high school and college. So in a sense, it was like my gap year between college and real life. And the two things that I learned was, one is I live in Boston now, but you know, I was from the Rocky Mountains, and being dumped into the middle of Washington, D.C. was just an unbelievable, you know, I just learned so much. And I also learned, I did learn that city living wasn't exactly for me. But number two, I learned that when you live in a political town like DC, people think in binary terms, and they really do. And they'll say that if you move there, you're like, you're in one camp or you're in the other. And I know now, and this was a long time ago, now the nation is really that way. But at the time, and I was just like, I don't think that way. I think about individuals. I respect that. I really admire people who can kind of think systemically like that, but I'm fundamentally relational. And so depending on who's sitting in front of me, I'm just going to want to have a conversation with them and learn about them. And so that's always where I was trying to meet people. And I was just an oddball in that world. But it taught me, I mean, but I also forged some rich relationships. But it taught me a little bit of something about how I like to be with other people, which is really in that, hey, I don't know where you're coming from or what your beliefs are, what your background is. I just would love to get to know you for who you are. So it really reaffirmed that call to more of a counseling or ministry vocation.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. That's cool. That's I think Washington, D.C. would be hard for me and for those reasons that you described. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay. So then so you decided to go into grad school and pursue ministry / counseling.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you did grad school and then your PhD. So part of your book that intrigues me is how much you sort of bring in your own history and your own past and to bear on the topic, which we'll get into down here on the road. But can you just talk about a little bit about that journey of experiencing coming to terms with some of these I don't know, boundaries
these different multifaceted parts of our souls, right? I mean, for me, I always, what I like to say is I, as a Christian, in one sense, I had it together on the outside, and that was comfortable for me, and I knew what to do to sort of be a good Christian on the outside, but I had no idea how to identify and tend to sort of the more inner complexities of anything from feeling lonely, from feeling a little lost, from feeling, you know, just any of those more vulnerable emotions that none of us really wants to face, feeling self-doubt, you know, all of those things. I didn't have any sort of access to my own inner world. I was very good, and I think a lot of counselors will say this, at helping other people access their emotions and their thoughts and feelings. I could help other people kind of understand more what was going on inside of them. I had very little access to my own. So I was in school, and I liked school. And so I was in school learning all this stuff, but it was from a very academic, analytical, intellectual place. And I wasn't connecting a whole lot to my own inner life. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that was really my experience for probably the first 6 years. I did 2 years in my master's program and 4 years of my graduate work, of just really, in many ways, skimming across the surface. I mean, I was doing good things, but as far as my own inner workings, very little understanding or work.
That's really interesting. I have a similar story in grad school, although it's analogous, I guess. I have degrees in theology and Bible, and I always knew a lot about God, right? And I understood things, but I never knew God himself, exactly. Right? And I think the two sort of are intertwined. I mean, your book certainly makes that case very clearly, exactly. But it's fascinating how we can do that, how we can compartmentalize this.
It's amazing. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
So what was it that sort of tipped the scales and brought you into more of a self-understanding, or even that understanding that you don't have self-understanding, I guess. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was a little bit of a crisis. I talk about it in the book. I was finishing up my last coursework, and there were other variables, but what had sort of happened slowly is, you know, the normal milestones of my friends getting married and moving away and having kids and setting up families and starting jobs. And I was just still sort of toiling away in graduate school. I didn't know what to do with, or didn't really acknowledge any feelings that I might've had around, gosh, you know, I don't have any friends left in town. I'm kind of lonely, or, you know, I just had no, and so I just kept working. I mean, I look back on that year as like, just keep adding more jobs, adding more, you know, I started tutoring, you know, and then literally one afternoon in the spring, you know, just, I found myself, ironically, I think we get, sometimes our emotions ambush us when we least expect it. I had a day off and I was like, okay, this is good. I need to rest. And it was that moment that my emotions were like, I had essentially a panic attack. I talk about it in the book, where it was just like, this is not okay. You know, and to use the language of the book, you know, it was as if parts of my soul were like, you're not paying attention. You know, we're here. There are other parts of you here that need more from life than just this sort of linear working, you know, in a silo trajectory you're on. And I just marvel at the human soul that God created, that he gave us emotions. He gave us desires. He wants us to be whole people. And it wasn't that I was doing anything bad. It's just that I was completely neglecting and ignoring aspects of myself that God had created and wanted me to cultivate.
That's fascinating. So we might as well jump off into the book then from there, right? So do you mind talking about the basis of the book, which is this sort of facets of the soul like you've been talking about?
Yeah. So, and I came to this later. So it was in hindsight that I was like, oh, that's what happened to me. At the time, I was sort of like, I just have to make a dramatic change. And so I made a really dramatic change and went off and started acting and did all this other stuff. And then as I was bringing it all together, I was introduced to this model, and it really helped me understand. And essentially the model is pretty simple, but and it's a model of psychotherapy that's pretty popular. It's primarily been secular, but more and more it's growing in Christian circles as it's been adapted. But this idea that there are three essential categories. We have three different parts of our souls. And everybody immediately resonates with this. We all have what are called manager parts of us that are sort of our you know, got to get through the day, got to get the work done, got to, you know, get the kids breakfast, you know, got to write the paper, whatever it is. They just keep us going. And then we all have what this model calls firefighter parts of us. And these are the parts of us that kick in when we're overwhelmed or we don't want to deal with painful emotions. And they're the parts that binge watch the television or scroll through social media mindlessly, or, you know, start a drink, having a drinking problem, you know, I mean, it, when they're extreme. And we all know that you'll notice, you know, you'll be like, gosh, I just like watch television. You know, what is going on with me? I can't stop watching this television show. Okay. Well, that's a cue that a firefighter part of you is overactive. And almost always when these managers and firefighters are extreme, it means this third category part, which are exiles, that there's a more vulnerable part of our soul that's in need. And we don't want to face it. It's, you know, it's just hardwired into us. Ugh, those are the hard parts of me, the parts of me that feel pain or feel isolated or are lacking confidence or are fearful. I don't want to deal with those. So we numb or we just keep driving forward. And those are sort of the three categories of, and in the model we call them parts, the three parts of our soul, but really they're just the three different ways at any given moment that we're operating.
Right. Yeah. I'd never quite heard it put that way or explained that way. And it just, it really does make a lot of sense. And so the point of understanding this model is that you can sort of befriend these parts of yourself, right?
Exactly. So it's the goal isn't not one isn't better than the other. And it's very the deeper I've gone into it, I see so much. It's so scriptural. We talk in the book about how Jesus, you know, he hung out with the kind of sanctimonious ones who had it all together. He hung out with the sinners and he hung out with those who are just suffering. Yeah. And he had different relationships with each. And so it's very much taking that layout and kind of applying it to your own soul. And the idea being that none of them is bad, but if your managers become extreme, like, and that's what had happened to me in graduate school. I just had an extreme sort of task manager, analytical part of me that just thought, and really they're sort of sanctimonious. Mm-hmm. I can just get the job done. I'm not vulnerable. I can just, you know, work through the night. I don't need sleep. I don't need people, you know, and they get these parts of us, you start to realize they kind of take on a life of their own. And if you're not aware, oh, wait a minute, that part of me really had to get humbled. And then as those protectors and firefighters, as you learn your own default self-sufficient mode, your escapist mode, you can go, oh my gosh, okay, I got to set some gentle boundaries and make sure I'm staying connected to those more vulnerable, fearful parts of my soul. And those are the parts we know Jesus loves. Those are the parts those parts at the margins of us are the parts that Jesus yearns to have relationship with. And so you can learn to bring those out into the light and you just have a more balanced, genuine, whole way of being in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you really spoke to a part of me and I think a part of just Christian tradition in general, where those things like you talk about, like drinking too much or those behaviors that result as a part of, you know, something not being right in one of those parts of the soul, we see them as just sin, right? And it's like, we've just got to eradicate that sin and we just become people who are more concerned with not doing those things than understanding why we do them, right?
That's exactly right. And it doesn't mean to say, you know, call a spade, the sin is a sin. But at the same time, you know, if someone's finding themselves looking at things they shouldn't be looking at online or trying to, you know, it's like, what's underneath that? What loneliness? Almost always, you know, there's a lack of intimacy, a loneliness, you know, and you still have to change the behavior and call, but there's a compassionate way of acknowledging these different aspects of oneself and bringing them back into alignment.
Yeah. I found such freedom, I think, in understanding it that way. So you walk us through steps for how to do that, right? Like that's the bulk of the book. Can you, I don't want you to, for sure, people need to buy this book and read it, but do you mind just talking through a little bit of the rundown? You know, sure. You don't have to go into it all, but just, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you want, if you're comfortable with it, I have sometimes with people, I can do a little mini, I can even help you kind of do an application so people will understand it more.
Yeah. I mean, yes.
You're like, maybe. That part of you, is like, maybe not.
I've been in counseling. I'm comfortable with those sorts of things, but if you're comfortable doing that, I'm great with that. So.
Well, and the thing about it is you don't even have to, like I heard you say, I could even say right now. So the first step, the first thing we talk about is if you're noticing anything extreme, like I can't stop working, or I'm a people pleaser and I know it, but I can't stop. Or those are the big ones are pleasing, perfectionism, extreme anxiety, extreme anger. You know, these are cues that you need to take what we call a U-turn and look inside your own soul. And something's out of whack, something's out of alignment. And so the first step is to focus. And so the first step, you know, and I heard you say, I won't make you do this, but you said something very similar to mine, which is I could have head knowledge of God. And that was a lot how I had a strong analytical protector that it's not a bad part, it's a great part, but I had to sort of focus on it and go, what are you about? Why can't I sometimes, why can't you sometimes give me a little space to just feel what I need to feel? You know, when you go through a heartache, sometimes you just need to cry and feel sad. And I had a protector that kept me from that emotion. So the first step is to just focus on it. And when you focus on a hard emotion or a part of yourself that's pretty stubborn, it instantly creates distance. And that's why we talk about boundaries. When you look at something, you're seeing it as separate from yourself. And so it's naming it, name it to tame it. You're naming, you're like, okay, I'm stuck in overthinking right now. So at least I, step one, focus. I can focus on it. Step two is to befriend it. This is a part of you that God made for good. It's a little extreme right now. But extend compassion. There's a reason it's working so hard. And a lot of times these parts of us that are real stubborn and really dug in are working so hard because of childhood stuff. They learned survival skills way back when, you know, and they learned just, you know, for me, just stay in your head. It's easier, whatever it is, you know, and so they're lingering from the past. So we extend compassion to them. You know, they picked these up long before they knew better, or we knew better. And then the third step is to invite Jesus. So if Jesus were to come into to be present with this part of me right now I'm struggling with, there's no condemnation, we know, in Christ. There's a calming. Often people often say, oh my gosh, I never even thought about what my anger, how my anger might respond to Jesus, you know? Yeah. That's always a fascinating question for people. What would happen if you invite Jesus to be near that part of you? Fourth is to unburden, because that's where then all of a sudden you start to realize the heavy weight some of these parts have been carrying. They think they're the only way. They're very self-sufficient. And so, you know, just unburdening them before God. And then the last step is integrate, where you're bringing back in. So if you've had an overactive part of you that overeats, to kind of help you numb out. And you're starting to realize, oh, that's just been my coping tactic for years. I didn't even know it. And you start to get some relief from it. All of a sudden, you got to start dealing with the feelings that you've been numbing out. And so you're bringing those parts of your soul together to work in harmony. And so when you have that desire to go grab the bag of chips, it's like, oh, wait, instead of beating myself up, just be aware, I'm going to feel some feelings. And what what you plan, you know, what can I do to, so it allows you to really take leadership of all these different parts. So those are the five steps.
Wow. Yeah. You even going through them, I was just like, I was ready to worship or something, right, you know, right, what I mean? Right. So good stuff. I really appreciate that. I love, because the whole idea is that those things aren't bad, like you said,
exactly.
Right?
No.
And can and are actually helpful.
They want to help. They've picked up some really bad habits along the way. And that's where we talk a lot with folks about, it's not that we're saying they don't sin. It's that it's sort of like befriend the part of yourself. A lot of times people, there's so much energy. Anxiety is a big one, a big part that people just can't get differentiated from, space from. And it's like, think of all that energy. You know, you can, oh, it's a sin to worry. Okay, yes, we want to change that. And think of all the energy that's going into that, that you could transform and use for good. There's goodness in all that energy you're putting into a non-productive activity.
Yeah. Yeah. So much so. Yeah. It's good stuff. It's such good stuff. I have a question for you to satisfy my own curiosity. Yeah. And I don't have to put this in the podcast at all.
Fair enough.
You know, I'm putting you on the spot, but I can't help but see the very significant parallels between sort of your model and the Enneagram.
Yes.
Is that true? I mean, is that, am I reading into that or?
No, I see it all the time. I haven't seen anything done on it formally, but sometimes I think of the nine, I think the nine Enneagram types are very much related to, because we all have predominant protectors. Mm-hmm. And when you see the list of, in IFS, the model that we use, there's the seven most common protectors. They map very closely to the nine, right? So I'm a two. So my predominant protector is pleasing. You know, I've had to do so much work to get healthy distance. Do I need to please right now? You know, and a one, you know, their predominant protector is probably going to be, how do I balance out this desire for perfection? Those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Okay. Well, that makes me feel better. I kept looking through. I was like, you know, when you quote like roar or, you know, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how much you had, you know, sort of dealt with that.
It's so helpful if I'm working with people who know, have studied the Enneagram, because right away we can get right into how to help them get a little space from their sort of go-to style.
Yeah. Well, and I... Yeah. So I was just recently in counseling and I'm a three.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I came to counseling sort of with this knowledge.
Yeah.
And it's very helpful, right? You're like, we have a basis of sort of start, like a jumping off point, right? Instead of, cause a lot of counseling that those first sessions can be just getting to that place, right? Understanding that.
Yeah. So you can immediately say, do you have a part of you that kind of fears with the three, like wants to achieve, wants to produce, and so if you're not feeling productive or like you're, that probably triggers a real vulnerability, right? And so that right there, you've got the protect, and just to keep an eye on that, what's the vulnerability, and you want, and the goal in IFS terms would be not letting that fear, whatever the underlying vulnerability is, drive the behavior. You want the Holy Spirit to connect to those parts of you.
Yeah, I loved, I really did really appreciate in the book how it wasn't just this sort of like God language that was used, but it was like the Holy Spirit entering in and like really transforming you. Yeah. I really did appreciate that about the book. So does that, I mean, this ministry counseling thing, I mean, it's just so prevalent in your story, right? Can you speak a little bit to just maybe calling or like why you do what you do, you know?
Yeah, boy. I mean,
sorry to open a can of worms.
In many ways, for me, counseling was hardly a choice. It was just the air that I breathed and what I knew, both how I think and how I feel. I mean, if you want to bring in other ones, my top strength finder is empathy. You know, so I have the empathy and then combined with a mind that is pretty analytical. And so it's always... And so just in many ways, I didn't want that calling. I struggled with God. I liked being in school. I liked learning. But when it really came to sitting with people, I struggled with that, with God. And I had to do my own work around how do you be present with people's brokenness and with people's pain and not know that. And because I have a little three wing in there. You can't always fix it. You're not always going to see the results. But it was just never for me. It was like, it's how I was designed. It was what I was designed to do, as much as time to time, you know, I'd try to find other things. Right. In the last 6 years, as I've grown and as I've really learned to tend to my own soul and place healthy boundaries, even I'll say to people, even empathy, you have to get some healthy distance from, because, you know, ultimately we're not, you know, there is differentiation that has to occur in order for healing to occur. All of that to say, I love what I do. And it's been just a blessing, especially I'd say for the last 8 to 10 years. But as much as I knew it's what I was supposed to, I love writing. The writing has been a real blessing to me because it allows me to live out of that analytical side of me without as much of the vulnerability of, you know, not always knowing how somebody's story is going to turn out. So anyway, the Lord's really allowed me to find a lot of different ways to use those gifts, but I certainly struggled against that. It required me to grow into what I think God has called me to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally, yes. So much yes. I keep getting tripped up because you remind me so much of my wife and just the way she interacts with people. I'm going to read a quote and I want you to comment on it. I don't usually do this, but like I read this out loud to my wife and she like laughed out loud. So it's from page 60 of your Boundaries of the Soul book. It says, on a hot summer day, Margaret marched into my Allison's office, sporting a black long sleeve sweatshirt with an image of a giant middle finger on it. I liked her immediately. I've learned that the bolder the armor, the more tender the heart. And
amen.
Right. I love that so much. Can you just speak to that, you know? Because people would see this Margaret, I think I just lost it in my head, but would see somebody like her and think, I need to stay away from them, you know?
Oh, she was tough. I mean, I had another client. These are my favorite clients. I had another client who had been arrested for assault like 17 times, a woman, you know, and she would have the softest heart of anyone I've ever met. I think it started for me when you talk about work, and it's very ironic, but one of the first jobs I had after Washington, D.C., I did an internship at the Wyoming State Girls School, which is the girls' school for adjudicated delinquent girls.
Right.
Loved it. I mean, and that's where I learned that. Those girls, you know, they were so tough on the outside and they were just the softest, sweetest, you know. And I just learned very quickly, and maybe I resonate that, you know, there's some part of me that wish, you know, I almost admire or respect that, just that bold exterior, you know, assuming, you know, that then you can help that person find and grow to be comfortable with, you know, the soft underbelly. But that's just been a common thread throughout my work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my wife, her juvenile delinquents, that was her first internship too. Yeah. So she was at a boys, detention facility. So
the best work. Yeah. It's the best work.
She says that too. I always have my concerns, you know, I love that, but I just love that. So let's jump into what your practice looks like now then, as you currently practice, counseling. And do you mind just talking a little bit about what work looks like for you now?
Yeah. I mean, so my private practice is primarily women, some couples in ministry. And that really came out of a heart for when I was hurting and when I needed help, needing someone who understood, you know, you say when you're a therapist, you need to go to a therapist who knows a therapist because we know all the tricks, you know?
That's right.
And so that came out of my heart for really wanting a lot of these women who are just pouring out, whether their families or through adoption or ministries alongside their husband or parachurch ministries, and they're broken inside, but they can't show that. And that's just another sweet spot for me. So that's primarily my practice. My husband and I, my family and I actually attend church at a Salvation Army, which is a little bit unique. And in part, that's, we do some ministry there. My husband and I do as a couple, and that's less counseling, but A lot of addiction recovery stuff, homelessness. And that's just because we, again, going back to what you're saying about your wife, we just find so much. We get so much from, it's like you're seeing people who aren't able to cover up their brokenness with nice clothes, or, and it's just all there, and you realize, oh gosh, isn't that just all of us, you know?
Right.
So very that's so, almost yes. My that's just is like, oh, it's so refreshing, like, oh, you know, whereas and in the world, you know, where you're on the face of ministry, we're doing you do kind of have to hold it together. There's that art though of learning how to show up as your best self and be vulnerable and be real. And so I kind of work at both ends of things.
Yeah. So I'm 10 years into vocational ministry at this point. My wife and I, we are on staff together. And I was just recently at a retreat, and I was in a small group, and I thought, I can't necessarily talk about all the parts of me like other guys in the small group can, right? Like even vocationally, like I can't talk about some of that stuff. You know, you're like, I guess when you're in ministry, you're sort of always on guard, maybe.
I experience that. I do. Yeah. And again, I don't know if it's being on guard. I don't know if you're just so wired. I have to really work if I'm not in a counseling environment, you know, if I'm in a small group or at a conference where I'm not on to, it's like that counseling, that ministry lens is always on. And so it's learning again, how to have a healthy boundary with it. And so, yeah, again, what's me and having a hard time, because sometimes we hide behind that, and what is actually, this isn't a safe place for whatever reason. It could be either.
Yeah. I think people vastly underestimate how much brokenness there is in people doing ministry. Can you just speak a little bit to what the sort of things that you've seen in sort of working through people in ministry?
Like everything. I mean, loneliness is a big one. Just a real sense of kind of isolation, a sense of shame. I mean, shame knows no limits as far as it just runs the course through everybody. Guilt, a lot of guilt. A lot of anxiety. I mean, just a anger. I mean, I could just run the gamut, but just,
for sure.
You know, just people struggling with, and again, like you're saying, there are a couple of ministries I know of that do a wonderful job of creating a safe space for people in ministry to talk about these things, because whether it's in your head or not, it's like, if I'm with a bunch of other pastors, it feels like, okay, I can be real here. And so I, other than just one-on-one with me, there's also some ministries around New England and there are other parts of the countries where you can get those pastors together and talk about, because what happens is out of those things, out of loneliness, out of guilt comes burnout, comes the really bad stuff we're seeing, you know, where real indiscretions, it's not good for anybody to not have a space to kind of bring some of that stuff up to the surface. I mean, look at King David. I mean, we always, in the book, we always like, look at King David, man after God's own heart, kind of a mess inside at different points of his life.
Very much so. Yeah. We're in a series on 1 Samuel right now at church. And like, I've been thinking a lot about King David and his life, you know, and really, God's love for David, even in the midst of such brokenness, is just always so beautiful to me, you know, it kind of gives me hope, right?
I
the work that you do, I think, is so important, and you are seeing, like you brought up, it's almost epidemic what's going on with pastors. I have lots of friends who have been pastors and have burned out and have fallen in bad ways, and you know, have succumbed to a lot of sin. So I mean, in your mind, are there things that we can be doing for our ministry leaders that can sort of alleviate some of these issues?
I mean, I probably have a strong bias here, but I think doing regularly, if not weekly, at least monthly, some sort of intentional one-on-one soul work where you're talking to somebody about what's going on inside. And coupled with perhaps, you know, one thing, the counseling sort of, we're more, what's the right word, as you know from your wife, you know, we have to do certain things. We have to do continuing education. We have to do consultation groups. We have to get supervision. We have to, and it really helps because you're constantly talking with other people in your field about the things that are hard, about where you're struggling, and there's structures for it. You know, I have my monthly, my quarterly, my weekly check-ins all the time. And that, and for me, because I did struggle with burnout early on, it's such a lifesaver. And I don't know that those parameters are as, you know, it's like if your pastor's going to counseling, shouldn't that be like normal? I often am saying this to my clients. I'm like, this is normal. It's not that there's something wrong with you. This is healthy. It's courageous. It's brave. It's you caring for you to come here because we all have stuff, you know, but for some reason there's this stigma. Oh, my pastor should be above that. So maybe the first step is to just reduce that stigma. But before that, just knowing as a pastor, as a ministry leader, I'm going to put these structures in place to make sure that my soul is, someone's looking in on it and helping me look in on it.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I had never thought about that analogy because my wife literally has to sit down and talk about what's going on in her life weekly with, you know, with a supervisor.
Yes.
Like, it makes a lot of sense.
It's mandated.
Right?
It doesn't. It's not like, oh, there's something wrong with you. It's like, this is what you do to be healthy.
Yes.
Yeah. We go to our doctor. You know, you go to your doctor to check in to make sure your body's healthy. So why wouldn't a pastor do that?
Yeah. We were just talking about this, and my friend Spencer was talking about mental health. And I think it's interesting that, like, mental health is just assumed and anything unhealthy is bad, whereas, like, physical health is never assumed, right? Like,
right, exactly.
You're always like moving towards physical health, but not mental health somehow.
And so I mean, you're just preaching to the choir, but it's so true. This idea that our mental health is static. Okay, I'm a mentally healthy person. Well, you know, I mean, it's the same as our physical. There's some people that are physically healthier than others by genetics or by nature, by nurture, whatever. But even the healthiest of people are paying attention. And so it's true with mental health. Even if you have a certain pretty even-keeled temperament, that's great. You're still emotionally, spiritually, and mentally always wanting to be growing and tending to yourself.
Yeah, for sure. That's good stuff. So you seem like somebody that cares a lot about self-knowledge, I would assume, from being a counselor. That's part of it. But we've even brought up some of these tools that are useful. Do you have some like sort of recommended tools for somebody wanting to get a little more self-knowledge and sort of maybe explore some of these things in their own lives?
Sure. I mean, so I'll start with, so this approach that we teach in the book is very much an approach that can be applied to, like, as we say, big T traumas, but it's very much also a maintenance approach. That if you find on my website, I have a list of Christian IFS counselors. There are not a ton of them, but a lot of them do distance. It really is a spiritual formation tool if you want it to be. So that would be one thing that would be sort of a regular way to just have someone you're checking in with. I've been introduced through a group called LTI, Leadership Transformations, Inc. It's here in New England. They do these quarterly spiritual formation retreats. That's what I was saying, where they tend to target pastors and ministry leaders and just deep listening, you know, 3 days a week, where I recommend those to people all the time as just a way to reconnect to what's really going on, get it out in the open. Nothing does well hidden in the hidden in the dark. So like I did one of those, and they talk about forging this, crafting what this guy Steve Macchia calls a rule of life, where you just decide, what am I gonna do weekly, what am I gonna do monthly, what am I gonna do quarterly to kind of tend to my soul? And it might be counseling, it might be meeting with a spiritual director, it might be meeting with a wise pastor or wise someone older and wiser in the faith, a discipler, but just being intentional about putting those practices in at regular increments, not waiting until you're desperate. It's the process of knowing, you know, Dallas Willard said, understanding is the basis of care. So knowing the contents of your own soul and knowing the different parts of yourself allows you to care for your soul. And that's the best gift that you have to give all the people around you, your family, the people you're ministering to, the people you're working with. It's so much about that presence and that you can bring when you're really connected and living out of a whole soul. So I just appreciate that you took the time to talk through this stuff with me. I just believe so much in these concepts. I always hesitate to use the word self-care, right? Because self-care has this connotation of, I need to get to the gym. I need to, do my fingernails or whatever. And all of that might be fine, but it's really this deeper caring and knowing your own contents of your own soul, just as you would care for your little family. You have your little flock around you, and you have your own soul to care for. So
No, that's good stuff. I really did. The book, I think is really helpful. And I love how I love the people that you go to, that you use, like Kirk Thompson. You brought up Anatomy of the Soul a few times, and like, that book wrecked me, just absolutely leveled me.
Yeah.
And then Dallas Willard. I mean, are you just a giant Willard fan?
How can you not be? Yeah.
So what would you say? I mean, what would you say of his works or some of the, do you have like a favorite or one that's really?
Probably, I think Renovation of the Heart. Okay. Was that one of his more recent ones?
I'm not sure.
I like that one a lot. All those guys. I mean, I've gotten a lot out of David Benner. He's more in the spiritual. I'm looking back at my books behind me. Oh, Mulholland. There's a great book, fantastic book called The Deeper Journey, by I think it's Richard Mulholland, that gets at all this stuff. I think he's excellent. Of course, all the Enneagram stuff is great. There's a few new books out about it that are Ian Morgan Crone, and those are all really great resources.
Yeah, for sure. I love that stuff. I get so caught up in those things. Like, I don't know, maybe like those sorts of tools for understanding yourself are sort of how I cope, probably inappropriately though, like with stress though. It's like, if I'm feeling unsuccessful as a three, it's like, I've got to do something to sort of figure out what's going on with me. So sometimes that happens in nerding out about, Enneagram or whatever tool is out, the Strength Finders or whatever. So,
Love that stuff. If you're into brain science, which not everybody is, but if you like the Kurt Thompson stuff, there's a guy, Dan Siegel, Mindsight. Oh, I'm listening to it right now. It's really interesting because he actually brings it to the level of the brain.
Yeah. So my wife and I, we're parent trainers. We have an adopted son.
Nice.
And so we're parent trainers for other parents that have children with trauma histories.
Wow.
So in our training, we ran a lot of Siegel. I mean, he's like
the guy.
For that brain stuff and how, trauma affects it. And it's good stuff. I'm going to have to look all that stuff back up. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, I have two questions for you as we sort of come to a close. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. So first, what is the strangest job out of all the jobs that you have ever had? Since you have such a repertoire, I mean, throw a couple at me. I kind of lament that we did not get to the acting phase of your life. So, if you want to, tempt us with a little bit of that, I wouldn't be too sad about that.
Well, probably, I don't know if strange is the right word, but certainly the most out there is I worked as an extra on several, and that is a bizarre experience. I don't know. Yeah. Do you know what an extra is?
Yeah. I mean, you're just sort of there in the scene, right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And anytime you see, so I was on a couple of shows and you see, you're there right next to the, I remember one with, it was a Boston Legal with James Spader, and there he is right there. And you're sitting in the courtroom, and you're 5 feet from him and your job is just a show with Patricia Arquette. I can't remember, but we were all supposed to look really grief. I mean, those were just,
that is so fascinating.
It's just sort of a bizarre, you get up really early and they do make, they do everything that you would do, as if you were a real actor.
Really?
And there are people that's what they do. They just love being on movie sets. So that's what they do for a living. It's like,
so what phase
culture
of life was this for you?
Well, I did it just for fun. When I first started the acting, I was living in Los Angeles and I just wanted to, I was like, I don't know anything about this. So I did it like, cause it's long, you know, you get up at 4 a.m. and you work all day and you make nothing, you know, you don't make very much money doing it, but it was just really fun. So I just kind of did it for fun, like maybe a handful of times.
That is such a cool experience.
And then waiting tables. I waited tables when I moved out there. And that is also bizarre because they're just all the celebrity sightings.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. So did you wait on celebrities, or was it when a celebrity walked in, everybody just sort of knew it?
You're supposed to play it cool. But I was at one point, I was at the front and we see the Secret Service or something. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger, Maria Shriver, back when they were married.
Wow.
And you know, they just come up and Maria Shriver's saying, oh, can I get a muffin for my daughter? And, you know, and you're like, why? Yes, Maria Shriver. Yes, you can have a muffin. You know, it's just, you know, it's that was, oh, there's Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Garner over there having breakfast, and we're going to just try to pretend like it's totally normal. You know, we're not going to go over and like, you know, so those were some of those Los Angeles. And that was when I was taking a break from graduate school and just trying in a way, I needed to pay the bills most of all. And I was actually working on my dissertation, but I have to say it was just fun. You know, it was just really interesting. It was way out of anything I'd ever experienced, and just a whole different piece of way of life.
You have great stories to tell out of it. I mean, it's definitely worth the stories.
Guess who I saw today.
Okay, so then finally, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring the kingdom of God into their vocation?
I mean, the first thought that came to my mind is what we say in our book, and that is inviting Jesus into whatever you're experiencing right now. There's no bifurcation. Doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're serving, you know, when I was serving a muffin, or if I'm filing papers, just being present to the power of God with what I'm doing right now. And it's just a wonderful way to live. And you know, teaching, whatever it is, it's that imminence of God has become so real to me that he's right there in the right now. There's no like, oh, this is the sacred thing to do, this is the non-sacred thing to do. It's where is he? Right there, right now. And it may be, I guess that's the practicing the presence of God thing, the Brother Lawrence.
Yeah.
And it may not be that you get the fireworks or the, oh my gosh, I get to share my faith with this person, but it's I'm convinced it's so much more about who he's making us to be in that moment. Yes, it spills out on others, but it's such a lovely way to live.
Amen. That is that's good stuff. I love that. That is so good. Well, thanks again for being willing to come on the podcast and just sharing. I really enjoyed our talk.
Oh, this was great. Good. Yeah. God bless you and your wife and your kids. And
I appreciate that. Blessings to y'all as well. I can't wait to see what's down the pipe for you. And good stuff.
Thank you.
All
right. Bye-bye.
Oh, didn't I tell you that episode was amazing? Allison just did such a good job. I encourage you, check her stuff out. I have all those links in the show notes. Check out her resources. She has amazing stuff. I have all the books she mentioned in the show notes. Go check them out. I encourage you just to lean into maybe looking at the boundaries of your soul and just how you can sort of befriend those places where maybe that don't act right all the time. I love hearing her passion for ministry and for ministers, and I just think there's a lot to learn there, a lot to delve into. So until next time, get out there and hustle.